Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Sherry. Been off for a couple weeks, but we're back with two excellent guests. First up is a regular, James Andrew Miller. Jim Miller, best-selling author of books on CAA, ESPN, and Saturday Night Live, the host of the Origins podcast. He comes on to discuss not only what college football moving from fall to spring or college football not being played this year, the impact that would have on ESPN, and it is significant, but a move that many of you might not have seen this week, but was very, very big in the sports media world, and that was Nick Khan, the former co-head of television for CAA Sports, leaving CAA to take a mega job as the president and chief revenue officer of WWE. That move has a ton of impact because CAA has and Khan specifically has a massive amount of clients that are people that you have watched on TV for many years, such as Kirk Herbstreit and Sage Steele and Mike Greenberg, Colin Cowherd. So Miller gets in and talks about the impact of that move, what's going to happen with the salary structures of sports television, which is a very, very interesting thing. And just sort of the financials today on what agents may or may not be looking for. So if you like sort of the business end of sports television, specifically the business end of talent on sports television, you'll enjoy that conversation. He's followed by Anson Carter, who is an NBC NHL studio analyst, also, of course, a former NHL player for a decade plus with a number of teams. Anson, who's an excellent hockey analyst, has a new multi-platform show called Hockey Culture, and that's highlighting stories of inclusion and diversity and people of color who work in the sport. And Anson and I discuss that new initiative, as well as if the NHL is serious about inclusion and diversity, how he felt about what Matt Dumba was doing, the defenseman for the Minnesota Wild. And then finally, Anson, somebody who's been around in hockey now for multiple decades, and his views on the hockey media and whether he thinks the hockey media is heading in the right place, whether he has seen people of color in either the dressing rooms that he was in or now as an NBC analyst. But Anson Carter is an interesting dude and always has been, and I appreciate his time on this podcast. So James Andrew Miller and Anson Carter coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top, Jim Miller, best-selling author, podcast host of Origins on this fine Cadence 13 podcasting network, and a frequent guest of the Sports Media Podcast with Richard Deitch, joins me. We've got a lot of interesting things to talk about today, Jim, and welcome. But here's where I want to start with. You know, the news is likely going to change by the time people hear this, but you know, there is a very, very strong possibility that we will not have college football this fall, or at sort of the very least, we're not going to have some of these conferences playing college football this fall. That, of course, impacts so many different broadcasting outlets, from Fox Sports to CBS to ESPN. And that's where I want to focus with you, just given your sourcing and knowledge about ESPN. Can you give my listeners just a sense of, like, on a macro level, what would it mean for ESPN if there are no games this fall?
If there are no college football games, it's a real problem. Obviously, everybody's been very anxious to get back into it with college football and of course, the NFL. But ESPN has spent over $20 billion over the past decade on college football. They have a bunch of rights, and they also have an enormous army of producers and directors and, more importantly, talent that are in the booth and who are in the booth, and they are anxious. They're all anxious to get to work. The thing that's kind of interesting is if you take somebody, if you take a team like Chris Fowler and Kirk Herbstreit, who are their top college announcers, and all of a sudden you say there may not be a college football season, what do you do if you're ESPN? Because you don't want to sideline two valuable, talented people like them and some of your other reporting teams, but specifically Kurt and Chris. And yet at the same time, when I tweeted about the booth, I don't think anybody has come back and said that was wrong about the Monday Night Football booth with the threesome that they picked out, Louis Riddick and Steve Levy and Brian Griese. But so it's a real pain in the neck for ESPN. It's a very, very difficult situation. I mean, you know, one of the things that they are doing also with Monday Night Football is you kind of basically have a new truck. I mean, Chip Dean walked away, Jay Rothman walked away, and now you have a new team in place, and you want to give that whole team, that those three announcers and also everybody in the truck, you want to give them the opportunity to really get established and get their reps in and hopefully make it something that is going to be for years to come. And you don't want to all of a sudden just hit the delete key on them and then bring in Fowler and Herbstreit for a year and then have them go back to college. So it's right now at ESPN, and they don't, as of yesterday, I know that they don't know the answer to this question. It's vexing for them, and they are trying to work it out. Obviously, they're trying to triage and understand what kind of college football might be still open to them. But as far as a game plan, they don't have one right now.
All right, we'll sort of like avoid the broadcasters for a second. That obviously is very interesting because, you know, I know from talking to the group that or from talking to people who are, I should say, close to the group who were named, that you know, they expect to call Monday Night Football regardless if there's college football or not. You obviously have this variable that Chris Fowler and Kirk Herbstreit would not have work between September and December. I think there's a larger conversation to even have as to whether putting Fowler and Herbstreit in an NFL booth is a good idea. That has nothing to do with how good a team they are in college football. That has to do with the fact that they don't traffic in the NFL on a week-to-week basis, and it's a very different sport to call. But let's hold that for a second, Jim, and get to ESPN and college football. You mentioned that sort of they've invested billions of dollars. You have all this talent. You have all these producers. What I would wonder is, in the same way that if college football is not played, a lot of these athletic departments have talked about sort of how catastrophic it would be financially, would you see ESPN cutting back at all on just the resources of college football, whether it's announcers, whether it's producers? Like, do you think they would use the cancellation / COVID to maybe just change the way they do business, calling games from Bristol, Connecticut, as opposed to sending these armies of people throughout the country? Obviously, the main game of the week still get called on site, but do they not do game day this year, let's say, and do that from a studio in Bristol? How do you think this, with no college football, so I'm sort of asking you two questions, but with no college football, how does it change heading forward the finances on all this, you think?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, something like College Game Day is absolute collateral damage, right? I mean, College Game Day is the antithesis of everything that's associated with COVID. I mean, you get like a bunch, as many college kids as you can in a small area, and they're on top of each other, and they're yelling and they're screaming, all the things that, you know, transmit the virus. And so I think it's a safe bet to say that we won't be seeing College Game Day as we know it this season, even if there are, even if there is college football. But I think regarding your larger question, look, one of the things that ESPN is doing, and this isn't just about ESPN and college football, and it isn't just about, even sports. COVID is a huge event in all of our lives, and all of the economics now associated with sports broadcasting, even entertainment, everything is being reevaluated. There are a lot of companies in all sorts of sectors who are saying, hey, you know what, we just realized over the last several months that we don't need to have, you know, people traveling as much as we do. We don't need to do it this way. We can do it this way. We can have a certain percentage of our workforce work from home or whatever. So I think that we're going to start to see myriad changes that are going to be implemented, maybe not necessarily right now, but certainly, particularly given the fact that there are some serious economic challenges that these companies are facing, that we're going to start to see whether or not, you know, things are going to change, not only just in terms of the sheer number of the workforce, but in terms of production exigencies and just the way things have been done for so long. And, you know, it was interesting to see. You saw Time Warner, Warner Media did on some of their processes about HBO Max and programming. NBC did some of it. So I think we're going to, you know, continue to see different changes coming along. And then it's not going to be just about ESPN. But I'm sure that there are people right now in Burbank or even in Bristol who have been gaming this thing out and looking at all the different variables and all the potential scenarios and saying, you know, how are we going to be able to do business as a result of these new realities?
All right, I appreciate you answering that. And undoubtedly, COVID is going to change. It's going to change everything. You know, I obviously think people listen to this podcast know I live in Toronto now, and just as something as at least in this city, COVID has literally changed the geography of the city with different kinds of bike lanes that now exist, spreading out places where they can eat on patios have sort of now been pushed to the streets, so less room for automobile traffic, more room for pedestrian traffic. So you're right on that, Jim. Writ large and writ small, it changes everything. So that's a segue to get to sort of the main topic at hand here, which is really falls under your expertise, which is why I wanted to have you on this week. There was a major behind-the-scenes move that got announced in the world of sports media representation. Nick Khan, who was CAA's former co-head of television and somebody who represented many, many of the people who you've seen on sports television for a long time, be it Mike Greenberg or Sage Steele, Kirk Herbstreit, Colin Cowherd, Jalen Rose, and, you know, a much larger list, Adnan Virk, who's been a guest on this podcast, has talked about Nick Khan. A very, very big client base, obviously. He, as wrestling fans now know, has taken a job as the president and chief revenue officer of WWE. He reports directly to Vince McMahon. That's kind of an amazing job. And, if you're Nick Khan, who I know happen to know is a wrestling fan, that's a once in a lifetime move. You got to take it. So Jim, this leaves like some very, very fascinating decisions in a world that you know well, given that you wrote a book on CAA. Nick Khan obviously not only represented some major talent, but he represented the WWE and the Southeastern Conference and Top Rank Boxing when they would negotiate with television entities, media entities, to put their programming on. So it's a major name who moves on to the WWE. But then this, Jim, sort of is, and this is going to be a long question because I want you to go long on this. This sort of all falls at the same time as COVID-19, where very, very clearly the industry is shifting and has already shifted for a couple years into lesser salaries, probably moving a little bit younger, and now a major change at one of these major agencies involving a lot of talent. So a couple things here. Let's start with the macro question. For listeners, and you should sort of go as long as you want, what is the move of Nick Khan leaving CAA to WWE? What does that mean for me as a television viewer, sports television viewer?
As a television viewer, I'm not sure you're going to notice something right away. I mean, Nick was obviously behind some major deals with, as you said, a lot of major players, and it's not like somebody watching TV today is going to be having a different experience. But I think it's a significant behind-the-scenes story, because the moment that his departure from CAA was announced, it set off a series of, you know, the proverbial dominoes throughout the industry, the representation industry in particular, because he had a long list of clients, and all of a sudden there was kind of a open season on them, as often happens when somebody leaves and doesn't go to another agency. If they leave the business, then it's kind of assumed that people are going to be thinking about whether or not they're going to change somebody, because their loyalty is often to an individual rather than to an agency. And so CA was doing its best to keep the people that Nick had, and other agents and other agencies were trying to decide who on his list were of interest to them. And, I spoke to numerous clients of his, and obviously they were getting calls, and there was a lot of interest, because Nick had built, you know, quite a list. I mean, look, I first met him in 2006, and he was at ICM, and he was part of what ICM was trying to do at the time, which was start this sports media representation business. And he wound up getting, I think, Keith Olbermann and Hannah Storm were really two of his early important clients. Chris Broussard was also there. And then he left for CA in 2012, which ICM was not happy about. CA made a big bet on him and brought him over. And he was able to really create, I think, a formidable and lucrative business. It just so happens that the timing for Nick arriving at CAA and really starting that, really building that business there, coincided perfectly with a couple things. One is the Skipper era, and John Skipper became like the George Steinbrenner of broadcast television contracts, because he was willing to go big and he was willing to go long, because he thought that ESPN needed it and the market, and he wanted to really own the kind of people he wanted. And the second thing was, there was plenty of money. And so that was a perfect table setting for Nick. And Nick wound up getting, you know, Kirk Herbstreit and Michelle Beadle and Sage Steele, and I mean, the list, Greeny, and I mean, the list was long. And he got involved also working with Jimmy Sexton and others there with coaches, and there was a lot of volume, and the deals were big. And obviously he had a relationship with Skipper, where Skipper trusted him, and the two of them could do deals together in a way that very few agents can do, with, not to say that other agents weren't doing deals with John Skipper, because of course they were, and other places were doing deals as well. But I think that Skipper and Khan had quite the run. I think also Nick and Jamie Horowitz had a big run, with Colin Coward, who had great success, and Skip, and there were some other big, big deals. So you start to think about the enormity of that list. But you also start to think about the fact that Khan was also kind of like, he wanted to build this empire over there. So he was hiring specific junior agents, and he was mentoring things. And, you know, he had this thing on Friday afternoons at 4 o'clock where he'd open up his doors. And I mean, other agents do this, but he really became quite fastidious about it. And he would kind of talk about the business and talk about the challenges and mentor people in more formal ways. And I think that whole kind of, there was a culture there that grew underneath him. Now, did everybody love him? No. He was very, in some ways, he was very controversial, because he has Nick had a very interesting way about doing business. He was incredibly calm about it, but at the same time, he had a lot of resolve. And the people who decided to challenge him and go up against him, I think, to the large degree, wound up regretting it. And it was never like he beat his chest or anything like that. I mean, I often said, you know, the guy's heart rate is like, you know, it's 60 beats per minute, whether or not he's about to close a deal or whether he's about to fire somebody or steal somebody from somebody else or has somebody stolen from him or whatever. He's just remarkably calm. But he was very, very aggressive, very ambitious. And I think the last thing, and then I'll shut up about this, is I think the thing that people realized also was he was incredibly loyal. You know, when Jamie Horowitz left NBC and then left Fox, Nick was there for him. When Skipper left ESPN, Nick was there for him. I think if you have Nick on your team, so to speak, you know, it was something you felt good about. And I think as a result, a lot of his clients, you know, were really stunned this past week. But at the same time, I think it's giving people, look, there are other sports agents and people who do what Nick does at other agencies who are really good at their jobs. And I think that the fact is that right now what's happening is that there are people who are getting to talk to these clients in a way that they haven't been able to for quite some time because Nick had them. And it will be interesting to see how it shakes out, how many people CA is going to be able to hold on to and who's going to decide to walk. And, you know, it's a really interesting moment. But the other part, and I think maybe this is the most significant thing, is I don't think we're going to see another era like that again. The economics of the business have fundamentally changed, and these contracts that Nick was able to put together of, you know, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, I don't think we're going to see a lot of those. I mean, obviously there's always going to be outliers, and people like Kirk Herbstreit and others are going to have their deals, and they're going to be paid handsomely, but again, I think it's going to be very, very hard to replicate, at least in terms of dollars and cents, the kind of activity that we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years.
All right. Let's first of all, there's so much praise in Nick Khan here. I mean, I'm going to have to go to my healthcare person. I'm in pain from this. But in all seriousness, he you speak to his clients and he was an excellent agent for them. You know, you may not love all his clients or all the people he helped, and that's certainly a discussion worth having. But they will all, generally speaking, most of them will tell you that he made them incredibly wealthy, and in some cases, generationally wealthy. So here's a couple things, Jim, that I want to ask you about because I know you're very, very connected and tied to CAA. If you're the two guys who are sort of taken over for Nick Khan, Matt Kramer, Tom Young, and certainly there are other agents who have picked up some of Khan's clients and probably have done so even prior to this decision, how do you go about, and this is maybe more just of you sort of freestyling here, given that you've talked to a lot of quote-unquote talent, but if you're these agents, like, do you have to make the sell to the client that, like, we want you to stay, we love you, stay with us? Or if the client is already happy about being represented by CAA, is the client sort of likely to lean that way because they don't want to make a move? Understanding that there will be agents from other agencies clearly reaching out to say, hey, Nick Khan's gone, I can do so much better for you. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're, let's take a Mike Greenberg type or a Colin Cowherd type, or if you're somebody like that, are you actually looking around to see what else is out there, or shouldn't you just sort of stick around with the agency that has made you a shitload of money?
I think that there's a couple different scenarios. There's somebody who, look, back when Mike Ovitz and Ron Meyer were starting CA, Bill Haber and others, one of the things that was really important to them was this team concept, because they wanted to kind of create some Teflon around them, right? So if you're talking to just one person and that person goes to a different agency, then that's the only person you know and you want to basically go with them. So they tried to have a bunch of people talking to you. And so if one person left, you were still felt like you were part of the team. And there are other people in Nick's world at CA, including young guys like Matt Olson and others, who have been part of some of these clients' lives. But if you really were if you were at CA because of Nick Kahn, and you loved Nick and you just wanted to be tied to Nick, then I think, you know, look, you're listening to other people at different places right now to hear what they have to offer and what their worlds are. And the other thing is, if you're somebody who is thinking horizontally, then you start to think about what is their speakers bureau like at a different agency? Do they have a great book department? What do they do with commercials and endorsements and everything else? So particularly if you're thinking about the fact that you're not going to be able to get, if you have a contract coming up in a year or two, and you're worried about whether or not you're going to be able to forget about an increase, whether or not you're going to be able to get that same deal, and you start to think, I may not be able to. So then the onus becomes on CA to try and say, well, look, we'll make it up for you elsewhere. But it also gives places like WME, which, full disclosure, I'm a client of, the opportunity to say, look, here's what we have here, and here are some of the people that you have here in us. I mean, obviously, people like Josh Pyatt, who work with, LeBron, and who worked with Kobe, and who have unbelievable track records with unscripted areas. And, so the Jim Morensteins of the world at WME and people at UTA and people at ICM and whatever get to say, look, this is what our agency is about right now. I mean, we think we can give you the same kind of service in your core business as Nick did at CA, but we also believe that, we have a new speakers bureau and we have new this or that. So it becomes like a little longer list of value propositions to the client. And I think that, I think that there's a lot of people who are listening right now. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be a lot of movement, but I know CA is working very hard to retain the people who are important to them. And the other brutal thing that kind of goes on right now is it's a little Darwinian because, when you talk to people at other agencies and they're looking at Nick's list, it's, well, yeah, not interested in him, not interested in her, not interested in him, or yes, want him, yeah. And that's part of the business calculation that those people have to make. And I think that the smart agents, I think one of the things that's happening at WME and elsewhere is if they're interested in somebody, those people know that they're really interested in them. It's not just to get another name. Nobody's in the business right now of just taking on more clients just for the sake of having another name on a list. I think that the people who are being pursued by the other agencies should feel really good about the fact that they are, if Octagon is calling you and Phil DiPicciotto wants to be in business with you or other people, it's because they really want to be in business with you. It's too hard to represent people nowadays just to have them, not be somebody that you feel like you can't hit a home run for. And so I think that those...
They're also still making money, right? I mean, they're still making money. I have no doubt they want to be in business with them, but at the end of the day, aren't you also trying to poach clients because they can make money for you? They can make money for your agency?
Yeah, but there's a calculation, Richard, that an agent has to make, which is that there's only so many hours, even for an agent who, takes phone calls in bed at 11 o'clock at night. There's only so many hours of the day. And I think what a lot of these, particularly the varsity in terms of representation in this sector, what they really want is they want a great list that they feel really good about, that they feel like there's a lot of runway ahead, both financial and creative, and that they can really commit themselves to, and that they're people that they want to be in business with. They would rather have, I think a lot of these people would rather have, let's just say, 8 or 10 of those types than 20 or 25 other, you know, a longer list that just are some intermediate or average players that don't have a lot of upside. Now, there are young clients at these places who may want to hire and desperate for a sports center anchor who's going to make $400,000 right now, and they believe that they could do that. And some of these leaders in these agencies are probably thinking about maybe assigning or having some of those younger people take care of them. But I don't think you're going to see a lot of people that, like, the, you know, go after Nick's clients who really don't believe in them and don't want to really have a great marriage with them. They're just trying to take them for just a commission. The business is just too hard right now, and these people don't want to be in doing that.
All right, so that's interesting. This leads me to sort of the question I wanted to get to you with about salaries. And so we've, you know, just sort of offline, me and you have kicked this around, but it seems that there's been course correction is like not the right word, because that would mean that it sort of like it was too high or something like that. But it seems clear that that places like ESPN and others are trying to lower their salary base significantly. Someone like Stephen A. Smith, or at that level, is still going to get paid whatever he or she is going to get paid. But it strikes me, Jim, and tell me if your sort of your understanding or just who you talk to is the same. It strikes me that the middle class, particularly of sports broadcasting, is going away. The $250,000, $300,000, $400,000, and again, that is not middle class in the United States. That's just middle class, like in this world. That person or that position is going away, and you're going to have some mega haves, but then you're going to have a lot of people coming into the business who are going to make significantly less money and probably be significantly younger. What have you seen or what have you heard about sort of the larger salary structure going on right now? And is there indeed a sort of a course correction amid both COVID and perhaps even prior to COVID?
Well, I mean, look, ESPN has, what, 8,760 hours of programming? I mean, you're always going to need people on camera. I mean, Steve Bornstein used to say that he wanted to hire robots. But I think you're going to – I mean, there's always going to be people making a certain amount of money. But I do think that if you look back 3-4 years ago and even at ESPN and let's say Fox or whatever, there were a good chunk of people making several million dollars a year, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think that I think it's not so much losing the middle class. I think it's losing the upper class. The upper class is there's going to be fewer Stephen A. Smiths and people like
No offense to Mike Greenberg, but that contract can never happen again, right? An insane amount of money to pay to him for fronting a morning show that, you know, at its best can average like $400,000, and now he's got a solo radio show. And I realize that's a lot of hours, but that $6 million for that, $6.5 million for that seemingly, I don't think happens in a non-John Skipper, Nick Connor, or, you know, have a great relationship universe. Or tell me if I'm wrong about that.
No. That's what I'm saying. It's going to be in the upper class. I think the middle class is going to actually thrive. I think that people who have these contracts that are $2-4 million are going to see significant hits. And not only that, but they're not going to have like a 5-year deal. They're, you know, it may be like a 2 or 3 year deal. And I think that's going to be important. There's one other aspect though that I think to give people kind of a sense of this subculture. It's not just transactional though. One of the things that people in this business do is they spend a lot of time in between contracts putting out fires. And so when you have a client who is on a show and that show is going down in flames, or a client who is on a show and the coordinating producer is making their life hell, or you have a client on a show that's not getting any marketing, or the two anchors are not speaking to each other. I mean, some of the stuff that Nick had to do with just the NBA show at ESPN, particularly when, you know, it was very volatile on the set. I mean, those are days that, you know, an agent earns their money as well. And I think that that's another reason why the Ornsteins and the DiPicciottos of the world and others are really thinking carefully about who they want to be in business with. Because when you have a client calling you and they need you, not to just get them more money or just not to get them a longer deal, but they really need your expertise in order to figure out a way to navigate out of a certain problem and a certain situation, you need somebody with the gravitas to call the right person at the network and say, listen, my client needs to be protected here and this needs to change, or we need this to happen and I can't let her or him be subjected to this anymore. And the client is counting on that agent to get those kind of results. So these jobs are, it's not like you talk to your client every time the contract is up. The agents who did that were the agents that Nick stole clients from, because those were the people that felt like, hey, you know what? I'm only getting people to pay attention to me when I have a new deal and there's a new commission in place. And so I think that it's really important for clients, particularly now, to understand that they're going to have somebody who's going to go bat to bat for them, because everything's so volatile and there are a lot of issues, and you want somebody who's going to be able to have the clout to you know, calm the situation down for you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You know, we could do so. I mean, you know, we could probably do like sort of just 2 hours on sort of the agent slash talent relationship. But here's where I want to end on, and it's sort of more philosophical. The interesting thing to me, Jim, is as we head forward, can you, in your opinion, still achieve what you would like to achieve in a business like sports television, you know, high-end sports media without an agent? I remember, I hope I'm right about this. I think John Buchagras told me once he didn't have an agent. And I know there was a time where Ryan Russillo, if I remember him telling me, this is long ago, my memory could be fading, told me that he might not have had an agent for one of his deals. But by and large, Jim, the talents that I talk to at the Foxes and the ESPNs and the CBSs and the NBCs, they all have representation. And generally speaking, the big ones are all with major, major agents. Having written about this, having written a book about this, like, is it possible? Can you go in and do it and still get your fair market value? Or because of the relationships that the agents have with the networks, because maybe even on the network end, they expect you to have an agent and might think differently of you and try to lowball if you don't have one. Like, I'm wondering, can you have the career you want without an agent? Or maybe just having a lawyer like read your contract over? It's always been an interesting question to me, and I don't honestly know the correct answer, if there even is one. How do you see it?
I'll just quickly unpack it with starting with your question about fair value. One of the things that, if you're, you know, a major player in this business, you have a sense of what is going on elsewhere. If you're an anchor and you have a lawyer who takes care of your stuff and just negotiates, they may do a great job of negotiating. But if you're somebody at WME or CA or Octagon or wherever, and you have your client list in front of you, I mean, at any point, Nick had like this little, you know, kind of card inside his desk. Unfortunately, he never let me see the details on it, but it was basically, you know, his clients and their salaries. So when you're negotiating for someone, you walk in and you're sitting across the table from, let's say, you know, David Burson or Connor Schell or somebody, or Skipper and Sean or whoever it is, and you're negotiating. You get to say, look, I know you're paying so-and-so this, and my client is much more valuable, and my client is going to be doing X, Y, and Z on top of this. So let's start at 40% more than you're paying this one. I mean, you have a sense of the competitive landscape, and you have a sense of what other people are making. And believe me, that is a big engine in terms of driving salaries up. Because you make a deal, you know, all of a sudden you make a deal for Hannah, then you use that to make a deal for Susie, and then all of a sudden you make a deal for Michelle, it becomes exponential. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, it depends what you want from an agency, because if your business is about, let's just say, going to ESPN, and all you really want from ESPN is a steady paycheck for the next 3 years, you're going to be a co-anchor on SportsCenter, and if they need you to fill in someplace else, that's fine. Then you know what? You can save yourself 10% or 6% or whatever you can negotiate. But if you want something else, if you want to be writing a book, if you want commercial endorsements, if you want to be doing a variety of other things, then that's when people start to really think that they're willing to pay for the agency, because the agency, the totality of the agency brings a lot of other things your way. And then you have a lot of different types of agents calling you. And let's say you want to get into, like Hannah Storm started producing documentaries, and you want to get in the documentary business, and you want to do scripted television. That's when being part of an agency really starts to have, you know, deeper added benefits for you. So it's just a matter of evaluating, you know, whether or not you want to pay somebody that kind of commission in exchange for those kinds of things. But in terms of understanding what the competitive landscape is, in terms of getting all those benefits from an agency, most people find that it's worth it. And the trick is just getting the best person and the best fit with you.
That's an interesting answer. I appreciate that. Jim Miller, of course, is the best-selling author of books on ESPN and CAA, has an HBO book coming very soon. His Origins podcast is on Almost Famous, so that's part of this network, Cadence 13.
I guess we should have a moment of silence for HBO Sports.
I know.
Kind of officially.
Can you believe?
Well, not officially.
Yeah, but I mean, what that was at once, and what it is today, man, it's amazing.
It's interesting to see that the two things that are really left, Real Sports with Brian Gumbel and Hard Knocks, in a way, are still staying as part of the HBO ecosystem. So I guess, you know, if you're Ross Greenberg today, you're feeling bittersweet about what went on in terms of what happened after your legacy, after you left, but he certainly has, he certainly gets to live on in terms of, you know, what's going to remain. It's been an astonishing story to chronicle, and I've been writing about it, and I think it's going to be fun to be in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's just from like Once Upon a Time.
Well, not fun, but
no, I know what you're saying, but like
dramatic.
Yeah, Once Upon a Time. I mean, between HBO's boxing and documentaries, and then of course Real Sports and Hard Knocks. I mean, what a sports juggernaut. But do you have a date? When is that book coming out? Do you have a date, a publishing date yet? Are you allowed to say?
I don't yet.
Okay, all right. Stay tuned for that. Let's hope you beat that Game of Thrones author. In terms of getting out there. Jim Miller, and lastly, you interrupted my kicker here, my close. Check out his Origins podcast on Almost Famous. It's basically it's everywhere that you can get your fine podcast. All right, Jim, listen, that was good. I found that very, very interesting and learned some stuff about the relationship of the agents and sports media talent. Thank you so much for joining me today. Stay safe, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
All right. Well, thanks for having me as always.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Anson Carter is an NHL studio analyst for NBC Sports. If you're a hockey fan, you are familiar with him. Playing in the NHL, 11 seasons for, I mean, a crazy amount of teams. Capitals, Bruins, Oilers, Rangers, Kings, Canucks. Getting tired, Anson. Blue Jackets and Hurricanes. He is on this podcast to discuss hockey culture, which is a multi-platform content initiative from NBC Sports dedicated to bringing equality and inclusion to the sport of hockey that just started this week. And it's great to be joined by Anson Carter on the sports media podcast. All right, Anson, let's just start here. Very much a sort of a macro question. What's the goal? What is hockey culture? And then what is the goal of this initiative that you're a part of?
Well, hockey culture is a platform that I'm very fortunate that NBC Sports was able to come up with the idea with allowing me to develop this platform to tell these stories about diversity in the game of hockey. You know, everyone keeps talking about hockey not being a very diverse sport. And on the surface, yeah, I could see when people could get that impression. But it's more diverse than people think. So this is an opportunity now for me to tell these stories about not just the diversity that we have in the game on the ice with guys like Seth Jones, who's really developed into one of the best defensemen in the National Hockey League, to I could talk about stories about Eustace King, the first black agent in the National Hockey League, to Kelsey Colzer, the first black female coach in NCAA hockey at Arcadia. Angela James, first black female to get inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. Like, there's so many great stories out there about diversity. Even Hunter Ryan Singh, the voice of Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi, who does a tremendous job there introducing the game of hockey to that South Asian community in Canada, telling the stories and, you know, calling the game in their native tongue.
These episodes are going to appear on YouTube during the Stanley Cup playoffs. Have you and or any of your colleagues, have you already conducted these interviews or have you already done these features, or are you still in the process of compiling episodes and content for the Hockey Culture Initiative?
No, a lot of the content, at least for this run up into the playoffs, has already been compiled. Which has been, we took really to get advantage of the stay at home and the pause, and we want to bank as many of them as possible because we didn't know about players' availability or guys being able to focus on doing something other than getting ready to come back and play hockey again. So we were able to work hard behind the scenes and bank as many of them as we can so that now as the postseason continues, we can just roll them out week to week.
Anson, I know you've spoken about this a lot, and I know you're a sports fan, so you've certainly seen what's happened in other sports, be it the NBA or MLB. We're seeing a lot of college athletes right now, I think, recognize some of their power when it comes to speaking their truths about systemic racism or police brutality. I would argue maybe the WNBA has perhaps been the best league of all. They were pretty early to this and have been speaking publicly for many, many years. In your opinion, and again, I realize it's a very, very big question, but where is hockey right now regarding these discussions, regarding Black Lives Matter? We've seen certainly a lot of public statements, but in your opinion, where is the seriousness in terms of rooting out racism in the game, bringing more diversity into the game?
We're not where we need to be, but we're getting there. And that's what I want to see. That's what I want to hear. And you're starting to see actions taking place. For the longest time, because hockey wasn't so diverse, a lot of the stuff that was happening within the game of hockey, not just NHL level, but the grassroots level of Hockey Canada and USA Hockey was falling on deaf ears. But now we have the right people's attention. We've got Pat Kelleher, who runs the executive director of USA Hockey. You've got Gary Bettman, commissioner of NHL, Bill Daly, deputy commissioner, Kim Davis, Don Fear. Everyone is all aligned with trying to eradicate racism in the sport. And for me, that's what's the most important thing, because it was extremely frustrating to keep hearing these stories in the past and nothing was being done. We're still hearing these stories now, but you're seeing a lot of swift decisions that are being made about fans, about players, about young players that choose to speak this way, and now it's not acceptable. And it's not just the black players or black executives that are speaking out, it's the white players. You know, you always hear about allyship all the time. Well, that's super important when it comes to hockey, because it is such a white-dominated sport. It's important to have the Blake Wheelers and the Braden Holtbys speaking out, the Tyler Sagans kneeling during hockey games. Like, that stuff's important. And people say, well, hockey and sports, it shouldn't be a part of, you know, talking about racial injustice and equality. Well, that they're totally wrong, because as a black athlete, and I'm sure as white people out there listening to this, it's part of your everyday life. You might not deal with injustices if you're white, but black people, it's part of our everyday life. So yes, we get to play the game and we get to maybe forget about it for a couple of hours while we're actually playing and competing, but that's who we are as people. We just can't remove ourselves from that situation. So I've heard it before and I'm going to say it again. Talking about racism isn't politics. Like, it's not. And whoever says that, you're being an idiot. Talking about racism, that's just common decency. I mean, that's a right that every individual should have, to be treated equally. And if anyone wants to say that's political, they got their head in the sand.
It's well said. I want to ask you about Matt Dumba, and just to get your perspective on this. He took a knee for both anthems. If I remember correctly, for one of the pregames, he put his fist up in the air, very sort of parallel and symbolic to what John Carlos and Tommy Smith did at the 1968 Mexico City Games. Initially, Matt Dumba was alone on this. A couple of teammates, I think Robin Leonard, I'm probably missing somebody else, eventually, I believe, took a knee with him in support. What I didn't really see, though, compared to certainly other sports, were more players during anthems actively protesting. That is certainly their choice, and I respect the choice of people who kneel. I respect the choice of people who want to stand up. But, you know, it does, Anson, get to a sort of a larger question I have for you, and that is, when it comes to the players in the game, when it comes to the constituency, some of these players have certainly said the right things publicly. Are you convinced that that's not just either performative or posturing or just sort of saying the right platitudes in the moment, and there's going to be sort of heft behind it? Or can you be worried that, you know, player X sort of checks a box, says, of course I support anti-racism issues, of course I support my teammates, and then sort of moves on?
There's a lot of performative activism going on right now, Richard. And yeah, I agree with you with that for sure. But, and to your point about, like, some of the guys not kneeling, I'm not really that concerned about that. And I think it's everyone's choice, and it's up to you. You could decide if you want to kneel. And listen, if you kneel, there's nothing wrong with that. And if you don't kneel, there's nothing wrong with that either. Like, you might feel and be able to relate to what a guy like Ryan Reaves is talking about or Matt Dumba is talking about and choose not to kneel. That's okay. You might be doing something behind the scenes that nobody's talking about, to partner with these inner-city underprivileged boys and girls clubs, for example, that don't really have the cameras around or the newspapers around to talk about it, but you're doing your part. So that's okay. I tend to focus on the fact that guys are willing to kneel. Whether it's one guy, two guys, it doesn't really matter. That's one or two guys more than what we had previous in the National Hockey League. So that's where my focus is, and that's what I like to see.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Here's the last one for me, Anson. And you played in the league for 11 seasons, and you're now part of the hockey media. So you have a pretty long, I feel like, a pretty long lens when it comes to the diversity or lack thereof of the NHL media, because you obviously played, you were in many different cities, you saw different press boxes or sort of press groups, and now obviously at NBC you're a prominent studio analyst, so you're in the television, the broadcasting end. From sort of my eye test, and sort of, I mean, you might not know this answer, and obviously every listener knows this, I'm a white male, so of a certain age, and generally speaking, when I've covered hockey, that is generally what I've seen. It's a little better now in the last 10 years when it comes to gender diversity. I've seen many more women, thankfully, covering the sport, but by and large, the sport, at least in the press corps, Anson, remains pretty white and pretty male. From your perspective, what have you seen from both the player perspective and now working in the business regarding diversity, people of color covering the sport? Has it gotten better in your eyes? And if it hasn't gotten better, are you optimistic for the future or are you not optimistic for the future? I'll sort of take whatever broad answer you want to go with on that.
It certainly has gotten better, Richard. And listen, when I played hockey and I grew up watching Hockey Night in Canada and then moving to the U.S. when I was 18 and watching all the coverage here south of the border, now being a dual citizen, you're right. I've seen a lot, both in Canada and here in the U.S. And playing in some of the U.S. markets and Canadian markets, all these teams, it's given me a unique opportunity to see how these different organizations are run, not just on the ice, but from a broadcast perspective. And you're talking from a league standpoint, you're seeing a guy like Bill Douglas, who's had the Color of Hockey blog forever, and that's been brought into the NHL family. I see Tarek Al-Bashir, who was an analyst, and he covers the Washington Capitals in D.C. You've got Kevin Weeks, NHL Network, Jamal Mayers, NBC Sports Chicago, the Chicago Blackhawks. You have David Amber, DA, one of the hosts and the co-hosts of Hockey Night in Canada, probably the biggest TV property in that country. So, yes, I have seen an increase in diversity off the ice in the broadcasting space. And it's not going to happen overnight. Just like on the ice, too. Like, we're seeing things change in the hockey world slowly. Like, the same number of players might be playing in the league than when I played, but you're seeing players like P.K. Subban win a Norris Trophy. You're seeing Wayne Simmonds, All-Star Game MVP. Seth Jones, Evander Kane, fourth overall. This year we could see Quentin Byfield go as high as number two. Some people say he could go as number one. I think the jury is out. I think Lafreniere is going number one with the Rangers, but Quentin Byfield is a player that could go in the top three picks. That didn't happen 15 or 20 years ago. It just didn't. Like, black players weren't evaluated the same way. And now you've got people in the media now that could talk about this stuff and look at it from an unbiased perspective. You know, before, black players weren't in the All-Star game. Like, it didn't matter what you did. I could score 30-something goals, and I wasn't getting called for the All-Star game. You know, now you see a guy like Anthony Duclair, who's one of the most electric players of the Ottawa Senators. He played in the All-Star game. So to answer your question, yeah, I think things have changed. I think things are continue to change. You see someone like Blake Bolden in the front office there as a scout with the LA Kings. So from the media perspective, as the game starts attracting and making more diverse efforts into reaching into those communities, you're going to start seeing more diverse faces covering the game and talking about the game and telling those stories.
Now let's hope that is the right direction. I'll give a shout out to my buddy who works with me at The Athletic, Ryan Clark, as well, covers the Avs in Denver and some other national stories. Does an amazing job.
Oh, and one more guy too. I forgot. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention even Javier Gutierrez. Like Javier, the first Latino president/CEO of the National Hockey League with the Arizona Coyotes. I mean, who would have thought that was possible? You know, you go back as far as having Scott Carlos Gomez. Gomer was the Calder Trophy winner as Rookie of the Year, Stanley Cup winner, New Jersey Devils, and that huge Latino community in New Jersey probably had no idea who Gomer was. So you have Javier, who's Harvard-educated, great hockey person that loves the game, coming to that market in the Valley was a tremendous Latino community, like talking about what impact he could have in the game of hockey there out in the desert. I mean, that never happened before.
Keep up this important work, Anson. These stories, they have to get out. And, you know, it's diversity in hockey is just, it's incredibly important. And I may be a little more cynical on this than you, but I am optimistic. I'm not 1,000% optimistic, but I think things are heading in the right direction. And that's where we want to head. Let me sort of give what Anson's doing again. Check out Hockey Culture, basically, is sort of the name of the project or the initiative. It's on multiple platforms for NBC Sports, including YouTube. And it's going to focus on telling stories of people of color and telling stories of diversity when it comes to hockey. And there's some people in here who just like their stories are amazing and have really not been, generally speaking, profiled by mainstream outlets. So it's well worth checking out. And you could, of course, catch Anson's work on NBC during the postseason. Anson is a Toronto guy. You're supposed to bring the Leafs the number one pick. I'll forgive you for that.
they had their swing. They had Austin Matthews.
I know. That's, as you can imagine, Anson, it's, DEFCON 1 here. It's, you know, Leafs Nation is not a happy group at the moment, but hopefully better days ahead. Anson, enjoy the playoffs.
If there's a year that the Edmonton Oilers and the Toronto Maple Leafs wish they played the postseason in the bubble, this would be the year.
Yeah, I know.
Sneak out of town quietly, no media, no fans. Get out of Dodge.
I know. I was really looking forward to. I thought the Lightning Leaf series would have been really fascinating this year, given no crowds and given playing at Scotiabank. But it'll be the Jackets. Seth Jones, that guy's crazy good. And it'd be, you know.
Oh, he's the best defenseman in the league right now.
He is.
The best.
He's
and
so
people
awesome.
People talk about Shea Weber, but I think Seth Jones is the best defenseman right now in the league.
Yeah, I know. Looking forward. If the Olympics ever happen again, it's going to be awesome to see that guy on the ice. Anson, thanks so much, man. Continued success in NBC and best of luck with really this important project. Thanks for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard. Anytime. And I want to give a shout-out to my crew, too, just quickly. My crew at NBC Sports, Jake has been awesome. Brownie's been awesome. Keisha, Marvin, Evan with research. Like, I have a really solid team. So everyone that's going to listen and watch what we're doing, it's not just me. There's a lot of tremendous individuals behind the scenes that are responsible for making that happen. So I couldn't sign off without giving them a shout out.
It's good on you, Anson. As having covered media for a long time, usually speaking, the way you can tell someone's not an asshole is if they mention their producer or behind the scenes people. So you've passed my test, Anson. Congratulations, and good on you for doing that. Thanks so much today for joining me, man. Best of luck. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Jim Miller and Anson Carter for their time and insight. If you like these conversations, head to the archives and check out some of the latest podcasts that we've done. The podcast prior to this, had a week and a half off, was covering sports inside the sports bubbles with Holly Rowe of ESPN, Tanya Ganguly of the LA Times, and Stefano Fusaro, I should say, of ESPN. So those guys were covering the WNBA, MLS, and NBA, and gave some really interesting insight on just what their experiences are like. Prior to that, we had ESPN National MLB reporter Marley Rivera. Jim Miller was on as well to talk about Adrian Wojnarowski. A couple weeks before that, The Athletic's Rhiannon Walker, ESPN's Mike Reese and Josh Tolentino on a number of different topics, Michael Lee of The Athletic before that, Jay Adonde, Lee, and just head down the list of the archives, and hopefully there'll be something there that you like. As always, this podcast benefits significantly from five-star reviews as well as positive reviews. That is pretty much how we stick around, a big indicator for management as well as downloads. So for those of you who have said some nice things over the years, and many of you have, I really appreciate it. It is pretty much the reason that a podcast company will continue with you, as Canis 13 has done with me now for a number of years. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry again for their work as producers. Thanks to Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, John McDermott at Cadence 13. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League Podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.